Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books in Anthropology channel. On the New Books Network. My name is Jolin, and I'm your host for this podcast. I'm here with Bienet Castellanos to discuss her new book, Indigenous Dispossession, Housing, and Maya Indebtedness in Mexico, published by Stanford University Press in October 2021. Thank you, Bienet, for joining me to discuss your book.
Thank you for inviting me, Jolin.
I would like to start our conversation by asking a bit about you. How did you become interested in Maya experiences with housing in Mexico? And what does this book mean for you?
I've spent 30 years working with Maya communities in Mexico. I first began working with them when I was an undergraduate student. I was awarded a Europe grant, an undergraduate research opportunities grant, to spend time doing field work in Yucatan. And one of my professors, James Fox, suggested that I spend time working in this small community called Cuchmil, but that's a pseudonym. I actually don't share the actual name of the community to protect their the families that I work with. And so I traveled to this community, and initially I was going to work the young girls. I was interested in looking at changing marriage practices. I was inspired by Margaret Mead's work. And I was also constricted by my own age and gender. You know, I was told that as I was, I think, 19 or 20 at the time. And so I was told that I wouldn't be able to have access to particular social circles, right? That I would be expected to spend all my time with the young women. So I decided to focus on that work. And I spent the summer working with these young girls. And then the following summer, most of the young girls had left. They had migrated out of their community. And I arrived in this community a year after the first road, the paved road, had been built. So that road made it possible for people to leave, because now all of a sudden there was a bus system that would come in through the community. Before that, in order to leave the community, you had to go by bicycle, by bus, or by like truck, because the roads just were difficult to traverse. And so I decided to follow these girls to the cities that they had traveled to find work. And so that ended up, you know, I've spent the last three decades studying these migration patterns and thinking about what it means for Maya peoples to leave their communities and to find work in the tourism industry. This is my time in Yucatan has also occurred during the time when Cancun has expanded. It's become this international resort. And so I was really interested in also thinking about the relationship between Maya migration and the development of Cancun as a tourist center, and also the development of Cancun because it's also gone from a small tourist center to a major city, to a metropolitan city. So I was also interested in that evolution. And that's where the idea for this book emerged. So because I had studied Maya migration to Cancun for so many years, the people that I was working with ended up staying in Cancun and working in Cancun. And so the issue of affordable housing was a constant concern. People could not find a place to live. Rent was cost about the same amount as it cost, you know, as they were earning in wages. And so the idea, so community, the people that I worked with were really concerned about if they couldn't find affordable rental housing, then maybe they could find land that they could purchase to then build a house on the land. And so then I ended up learning about the Cancun's housing and land policies. And the community itself urged me to make inquiries on their behalf because I had access to government officials to ask them about, you know, how could they could actually gain access to land. And so that's sort of where the idea for this project emerged. I was really interested in helping the community figure out ways to get access to land. And during that time period when I started making these inquiries, which is around 2000-2001, I also noticed that there was a shift. The local housing, the local policies around land were initially that the government would redistribute land to working class migrants. But then around this time period, there was a shift where the government ended land redistribution policies. And so the opportunities for people to access land, to gain access to land, was very limited. And so now all of a sudden, what the government did was they started to support the building of tract housing developments that were affordable, but not quite, right? They were somewhat affordable. And so they really pushed for local people to actually buy these homes. And so then that sort of became part of this project, is thinking about, well, are these homes, you know, affordable? What does it mean to buy a home? Because then you actually go into debt to because you have to get a mortgage. And so, you know, there was the community that I was working with is very critical of this process because they were averse to going into debt. They had experienced the history of debt servitude when in their family, through their history with their experiences with haciendas, with plantations, economies. And so they were very hesitant to make that move. And so over the span of four or five years, I noticed that initially when they were hesitant, then by 2005, they were all jumping into purchasing these types of homes. And so I was really interested in that shift from, you know, seeking land to then moving into buying a house and thinking about what that transition meant in terms of Mexico's, booming housing economy, but also in terms of the relationship to the Great Recession and the housing bubble in the U.S. and thinking about housing bubbles in Mexico, but also thinking about shifting property regimes and the ways that governments use land or houses to create docile citizens, to create, to also manage populations. So that's sort of where the project emerged. So this project is very important for me because it gave me an opportunity to actually write a book that was at the behest of my interlocutors. I did not write this book because this was like my first book was an outcome of my dissertation work. And this book was really in response to people's needs and urgent, housing situations. And so for me, it was really important to write a book that sort of drew upon all these issues around policies because, you know, this has, you know, it's a book that's meant to have policy implications. It's not a book that's meant to focus primarily on theory. And so that's part of the reason why I also include a lot of people's personal stories. Because it's, I think, one of the challenges of writing a book that has policy implications is to be able to understand how these policies that get instituted by governments or by, local ordinances or things like that, urban planners, you know, what their real life effects are on people. And so that was part of the reason why this book is really important to me and to the people that I work with, because it really is addressing important issues that they're tackling with on a daily basis and will continue to tackle with. These issues around affordable housing are not going to go away. They're going to continue to plague, the ability for Cancun to house new incoming migrants, to house its current residents, and then also to grow in the future. And it's going to impact the way that they expand, right? And so that's part of or the way the city expands. So that's part of the reason why this book is a special place for me, because it had a very different vision in the way that I put it together. And part of that, you can see that in the way I organize. The book is organized for people to understand how these policies shifted. And I talk about property regimes because I really see
that prior to 2000, the ways that governments were involved with providing housing was rooted around a particular understanding of land as, you know, their mission was to redistribute land to people. And so when you have housing policies organized around land redistribution, then what you see happening is very different from when you have housing policies organized around markets, financial markets, where, you know, where you have mortgages and, you know, as sort of the fundamental underpinning of sort of how housing policy happens, right? So if you're building houses that you're going to sell and people have to get a mortgage to get access to that housing, that's very different from being given land, right? Because the land, the way that the government gave land in the past, it was affordable. The land was given at affordable prices, whereas the mortgages are regulated by markets. So it's a very different kind of process. So I was really interested in that kind of transition because it was a pivot away from a particular understanding about the relationship and the obligation that governments had to its people, to this new approach, a neoliberal approach about the individualization of debt, that and the government was basically putting that on individuals and not becoming as involved or as feeling as responsible for having to create policies that support or subsidize these kinds of projects, right? So they're, well, they're still subsidizing housing, but they're not necessarily subsidizing mortgages, right? So thinking about that, a lot of that, the impetus or the responsibility for housing falls on the individual, in comparison with in the past where the government was heavily involved with land distribution and making it an affordable practice.
Right. And you mentioned that Cancun, the city, it was developed by way of some historical context. Can you sketch for us a picture of what was happening in Cancun in the second half of the 20th century and how this history bears on your research?
Yeah. So Cancun, in the 1960s, Cancun was a small fishing village. Until the Mexican government decided that they were really interested in developing tourist centers throughout the country as a way to capture foreign exchange. This interest was an outcome of the fact that the Bracero program, the Mexican government had been involved with sending guest workers, braceros, to the United States to work from 1942 to 1964. The Bracero program ended in 1964. And so as a result, the government was trying to figure out ways to generate new kinds of jobs for braceros who were returning back to Mexico, and also thinking about ways to buttress its own, you know, economy. And so they thought that tourism was an ideal way to do that. They had seen other countries like in Spain and Morocco, that they had seen these countries create these robust tourist economies. And so they traveled around the country looking for a place where they could create what they considered to be a tourist center, a tourist pole. And they visited the Yucatan Peninsula and decided that Cancun would be the perfect place because they deemed it to, or they considered it to be what's called vacant land. And they felt that because it was vacant, then they could build whatever they wanted there. And so they imagined that they would create this metropolitan city where they would attract 500,000 settlers. And they would develop this, you know, amazing tourist center. And it would generate, great income for the country, right? And so that was the vision of Cancun, was to create this international tourist center that would generate a lot of income for the country. And so, and that's what they ended up producing, this city. But in the process of imagining the city, of what they did is that they actually then erased the history of indigenous peoples in this place. They ended up, you know, claiming that this was a new place. They claimed that there were no Maya people here, that it was just a city of immigrants. And so then they didn't feel that they had to actually address any of the issues that resulted from the expropriation of these lands from Maya communities, and so that they could then go ahead and build this tourist center. And when they actually planned the center, they planned the center to have, you know, this tourist zone where you had the hotel zone. They planned it to have a downtown and housing around the downtown for the middle class or the people who actually would staff the downtown, and would, but they didn't actually plan for the workers. So there was no housing created for workers. So when they started building the hotels in the late 1960s, they recruited Maya workers from the surrounding countryside. And these people had to show up and basically camp in the jungle because there was no place for them to really live. And so what you ended up having was that the city itself was surrounded by squatter settlements. And so eventually these squatter settlements became incorporated into the city itself. But, you know, this is a process that took a long time. But all of this happened, you know, it took a long time to incorporate the squatter settlements, but at the same time, it happened very quickly. So you went from a small fishing community to a city of, you know, now there's close to a million residents, right? Settlers in the city, within a span of 50 years. And so a city that's built that quickly, can't possibly address all the needs of its residents or, create the infrastructure, you know, in a planned way or in a way that's going to actually, make it possible for people to live, you know, to live well, right? And so because a lot of that growth was haphazard, you know, they incorporated shanty towns as they were built. And so then, you know, people built their homes and then they would build schools and they would build roads and they would build electricity, you know, lines to connect all these communities to the electrical grid. And so it was kind of haphazard planning for working class residents. The planning for the middle class residents, that was done strategically and thoughtfully, but for the people who came later, that was all done, you know, as people arrived. And so that, so when you think about the city itself and you look at the way it's grown, you can see that, that there's the kind of care that was given to the hotel zone and to the downtown is it's, they're trying to, you know, they don't have the funds to be able to do that kind to build in the, with the same kind of care, for the outskirts of the city.
You touched there on the fact that indigenous migrants are sometimes considered settlers or colonos by various actors, mm-hmm. And you discussed that in the book. However, you make a point of not framing Maya people as settlers. Why is that? And how does your approach here help us understand what's going on in and around Cancun? Mm-hmm.
Well, the goal of the city was to bring in settlers, right? And so the local government considers the residents to be settlers. But Maya peoples, because this is their traditional homelands, while they may have left their local community to migrate to Cancun, to work in Cancun, they are still living on traditional homelands, you know? And so for them, they still have a particular relationship to this land. They talk about how the land, they're connected to the land, you know, through the cosmos, are connected to the land through their relationship to the local ecology. And so this idea of Cancun as a city of immigrant, a city of immigrants or even migrants, then negates that history, that relationship that Maya peoples have to local ecologies, to also the kinds of cultural practices that they continue to foster and promote in Cancun. So the city is seen as this cosmopolitan city, and that's the image that it's trying to produce. But at the same time, you see lots of hints and references to Maya traditions and customs, but those are practiced. What they sell is that they sell Maya culture to generate, you know, to consumers because it's attractive, but they don't have the same kind of investment in Maya peoples that you would assume because they're elevating Maya culture as a tourist attraction. But the people themselves do not receive that. They don't have the same kind of they don't receive any benefits from that kind of consumption, right? And so, and they actually aren't being their traditions and their practices are not recognized in the city because the way that the Mexican government has structured its relationship to Maya pueblos in the peninsula is that Maya pueblos have autonomy and they have rights when they're within their pueblos, which are in the countryside. When Maya migrants move to the city, they're not recognized as indigenous peoples. They're not given rights. So when in Cuchumil, the community has rights. They have a particular relationship to the government. They can make requests. They can make demands for certain kinds of resources because they are an indigenous pueblo. But when they migrate to the city, they're not recognized as an indigenous pueblo. So they actually can't make those claims on local governments. And so that's part of the reason why I pushed back against the idea of calling them settlers, because it then doesn't account for the relationship that they have with their traditional homelands. It doesn't account for the obligations that governments have to indigenous pueblos. And so that's part of the reason why I do that. And I'm hoping that it'll foster conversation around, like, who is a settler? And why we even talk about, you know, why we need to talk about settlers versus migrants, why we need to talk about, I talk about how they're positioned as settlers and how that conversation around thinking about how people get positions as settlers opens up new opportunities to having conversations about what are the needs of indigenous peoples when they are in cities, when they live in cities.
In chapter one, you talk about Nadaida's process in acquiring housing. And can you explain why you decided to highlight her experience and walk us through how that went for her?
Yeah, chapter one looks at Cancun's housing policies prior to the shift from away from land distribution to housing policies oriented around mortgages. And so I highlight Nereida's story because Nereida was able to get land through the Cancun's land redistribution policy. And so she was able to acquire a plot of land. And so I was really, so her process of going through and getting that land is particular for that moment, but it also shows you how radically different it is from the kinds of practices we are used to, right? When we think about and this is a global practice of getting a mortgage and how you get a house. You know, you have to get a loan, and then you're given the keys to your house, and you move into your house. Your house is already built. In Cancun's land redistribution program, the way it worked is that the government would expropriate land from local ejidos, which are communal land holdings that work the land and own the land collectively. And so then that land would then be carved up into plots, small plots, 10 by 12 meters, that would then residents could then build their own house. So this is what's called self-built housing. So the government isn't involved in building the house. So the local residents have to build their house. They have to bring in their own water. They have to bring in their own electricity. So it's all done, as people can afford to put all these things into place. And so, but what it was really interesting about Nadia's experience is that, you know, in order to be able to get access to this land, because there are more residents than land available, she had to really get involved in local politics to do that. So what I do is I follow her as she goes through and joins a grassroots organization that's lobbying for its members to get access to land. And they argued that if the more activity she was involved with on their behalf, then she would move up the list, the waiting list, because they had a lot of political power and clout and could, you know, move her up the list so she would get access to land. So she ended up going door to door, like leafleting. She ended up doing voter registration drives. She would participate in political rallies. And through that kind of activism, she was then able to move her family up the list, and she was able to get her plot of land where she was able to build a house. And so that was a process before. So being able to get access to land in Cancun was not just like signing up and saying, okay, I want land. It really did. It does involve, becoming involved in local political practices. And in many ways, she talked about how it didn't make her, because a lot of the concerns are that these grassroots organizations have been bought by political parties, right? That's some of the critiques of these organizations. And for her, she said this being involved in these practices meant that she actually became very much invested in advocating for herself and for her family.
So in this first chapter, you elaborate on the idea that state funding policies reify certain gender relations. Can you give us a sense of how that played out?
Yeah, so part of the Nereida's example is a really good example of how that happens. So for in order to gain access to land in Cancun to these programs, you couldn't just be, for example, a young man. If you wanted to get access to land, you couldn't participate in those programs. There were restrictions. You had to be married or in a common law marriage. You had to have children. And so it really did cater to a particular sector of the working class community, right? So if you were a young man or a young woman who was single, who was not, you know, who didn't reflect this heteronormative family, nuclear family, then you actually weren't eligible to get access to land. And so really it did. So the people who actually own homes in Cancun have to fit this model. So whether you adhere to it or not, you have to actually play this role. And so that's why I talk about how housing policies or land policies during this time period were very much modeled on these gender ideologies that were rooted in the nuclear family. And it really was about this idea of what kinds of citizens do we want to support? We want to support the citizens who are married. We want to support citizens who have families or single mothers who had families. They too are eligible, right? But it was really about creating a particular kind of citizenry in Cancun that they felt was the more that was going to create a more established community that was going, it wasn't, they weren't going to just like, that they were actually going to settle, you know, stay, that they're going to become a stable workforce. Because if you have a family, you want to stay in Cancun. Whereas if you're a young man or young woman and, you know, you get, you find that the work is not, you lose your job or you find that you're given a job somewhere else, you could just leave and go somewhere else, right? So the idea was to create like the future, to like support the future residents of Cancun because you're supporting families. And so, but it meant that a lot of people who were ineligible for those kinds of programs then had to figure out other ways to gain access to land because they actually couldn't participate in for example, Invicro's land redistribution policy, which was Invicro was the organization that was distributing land for the local government at that time.
What exactly is patrimony or patrimonio in Spanish? Why does it matter? What's the connection between patrimony and the neoliberal Mexican state and its push for social housing? In particular, I'm curious about the role President Fox plays or played here, and then eventually what housing reform is.
Patrimony or patrimonio in Mexico is typically conceived as a shared bundle of rights to resources that is controlled by a collective or social group. And so these resources are inalienable, as they cannot be sold. People just have rights to work the land. And so a classic example of patrimonio is the ejido, which are communal land holdings. And these in the ejido system, land is held collectively and it's worked. Families have rights to work the land, but they can't, and they can pass it down from generation to generation. This is why it's called a patrimonio, because it's a legacy. But it's a collective legacy, right? That's managed collectively. So what former President Fox does in order to promote what I call housing reforms, these are, you know, shifts to the way that housing is administered nationwide, is that he actually links housing reform with patrimonio. And he says in a speech that he gave in Paseo Escobá, which was a social housing development in Cancun, he says that, the patrimonio that you're going to, the legacy that I'm going to give you is I'm going to actually give you access to a house. He promised to build $750,000 homes and provide 750,000 home loans. And he argued that this was the best way for people to, you know, this was the new kind of legacy that families would give to their children. And so what, and so it might not seem like a big deal. You know, we think of our homes also as our legacies, right? But what he was doing is he was linking this idea of patrimonio that emerged out of the revolution, you know, emerged out of revolutionary mandates for land and liberty. And that were very much rooted in providing access to land for working class and indigenous peoples. And he linked that ideal, which was a national ideal. You know, Mexico had built its sense of national identity around these ideas of the revolution. And he linked those ideas, which were very popular, to housing reform by saying that, you know, in the current day, our patrimonio is no longer land, but it's the house. But what is a house in this context? A house is actually a mortgage. It's a loan. So a house is really debt. And so by linking patrimonio to debt, he made it a palatable idea, right? So this is what he was trying to convince people, that they no longer wanted land because they weren't going to be distributing land anymore. And they had to, you know, make that be okay, right? People had to stop wanting to actually getting access to land, which was not the case. People still wanted access to land. But he had to make it palatable for them to then pivot and say, okay, instead of demanding land from the government, we're going to be demand a house. We're going to actually, you know, acquire a loan to purchase our home. What former President Fox was also trying to do is he was actually trying to move Mexico away from the ejido system of collective land holding and towards a what he called a property-owning democracy. And this was based on an economist, Hernando Soto's idea that the way for capitalism to thrive in Latin America is for people, individuals, to own property. And that once they own their own property, then they could capitalize it and stimulate the economy. And so he really bought into this idea, and he wanted to move away from this idea of collective land ownership to individual land ownership. And so using the concept of patrimonio in this way was one way for him to be able to make that shift and to convince people to also to think that this was a good idea.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, and as you discuss in the book, this really matters, because actually, even now, still much of Mexico's land is in ejido holdings. I'd like to ask you now about Fatima, and what her story reveals about the lived experience of Maya women with microcredit. Speaking of debt, actually.
Yeah, I introduced Fatima because her story is a great example of how microcredit is gendered. And it also challenges the narrative that microcredit empowers women. But I'd like to take a step back and return to former President Fox, because Fox was a big proponent of microcredit. He thought that microcredits were a way for, to empower working class folks so they could become entrepreneurs, so they could then, generate a lot of economic activity. And he felt that this was one of the ways that he was going to pull people out of poverty. He had seen what had happened in Bangladesh, and he was so inspired by the fact that they were investing in their poor, right, and making it profitable. And so then he thought he wanted to bring this model to Mexico. And so this is where the push to expand microcredit began. And Fatima and her sister convinces her to join a group of women who actually request a microcredit grant from this bank called Compartamos. And the microcredit in this case is organized around, it's similar to what we call a tanda in Mexico. And this is a rotating credit association where you have a group of people who pool their money together every week, and they dole out that pot of money to one member. And they do it. So for example, if you have 10 members, you do it for 10 weeks. And so every week somebody gets that pot of money. And so it allows them to pool their resources so that instead of having, 100 pesos that week, then you can have 1,000 pesos. And then you can use that towards whatever needs you may have. And so Compartamos modeled their micro program credit around this idea of a tanda. And so these women pull their resources together, and they each week they would then get a pot of money that then they would then distribute amongst themselves and use it. And so what the bank did is they gave them the initial pot of money with the goal that not only would each week they each contribute to that pot to repay that pot of money, but that they would also then set aside some money to save that, in addition to save that money, along with that pot of money, so that when they finished with the program, not only would they have, been given that pot of money that they had all contributed towards, but they would also then have some savings on the side that they could use to invest in whatever business they had requested the funds for. And so Fatima participated in this microcredit with her sister and neighbors. And the first time, it didn't always go well because one of the participants wasn't able to pay back her contribution. And so when a member drops out, then everybody else has to pitch in. So they ended up losing money. They didn't make as much money as they thought they were going to make. And, so her husband urges her not to do it again. But the second time she got invited, her brother wanted to use this as an opportunity to save some money. So he said, if you join the organization, then the money that you save on the side, I'll give it to you so you can save money. And then we can, have this savings through this process. And so she did. She joined. But this time the treasurer absconded with three or four payments towards the end of the project. And so what the group did when they got gathered together and they realized these funds were missing, is they decided then to take Fatima's money and use it to pay the difference, because they didn't want to be at fault with the bank. And in both cases, the bank got paid. The people who had to take the losses were the people who were involved in the group. And so she was very upset because she had been late to the meeting. And so when she showed up, they had basically used her funds, and she didn't know. And they said, if you need the money back, you need to ask for that money from the treasurer who absconded with the money. But the treasurer never paid her back. And she was very upset because she felt like this was supposed to be a microcredit program that was supposed to empower women. It was supposed to be a group where they worked in solidarity with each other. The name of the group, Compartamos, is to share. So they were supposed to support each other so that they could then, invest in whatever kinds of businesses that they were trying to develop or pay back whatever debts that they needed to pay. And so she felt that the group had let her down, and it really did destroy the social ties she had developed with these women. So that it basically, and even with her own sister, she was very upset by the fact that her sister, even though her sister didn't want to use that money, she was outvoted. And so her sister she didn't actually suffer an economic loss. And so she was very upset by that whole process, because she felt that she had joined this, she'd requested microcredit so that she'd get ahead. But now she was behind. And it really made her wary of these kinds of programs. And microcredit organizations around the world have been touted as supporting, poor women. And in this case, in Cancun, the microcredit organizations are actually targeting indigenous women. So they're supposed to empower indigenous women to become financially stable or to improve their financial circumstances. But in this case, what it did is it basically left her, it frayed her social relationships with her brother and her sister. And it also left her, without the savings that she had set aside so that she could actually become more financially stable. And so that was a big challenge for her because she felt that the idea of credit is touted as something that's good. It's going to give you opportunities because prior to 2001, there weren't a lot of credit opportunities for working class residents. And especially for women like Fatima who don't have a job, she's a stay-at-home mom. And so she actually can't go to a store, at least prior to 2001, she couldn't go to a store and open up an account and get a credit so that she could purchase anything from the store. She had to rely on her husband who had a job. Her husband could open up an account and purchase like a computer or whatever he needed from the store, but she couldn't do that. And so what the microcredit industry is doing is it's making it possible for these women to have access to credit, but it's not necessarily but because of the way it's structured, even though it's modeled after traditional practices like tandas, and what it's doing is it's actually using the tanda as a way to make microcredit accessible or legible to local residents, but it doesn't actually account for the fact that it's relying on these social ties that are actually very weak, right? Because in Cancun, everybody has to, everything's very expensive. People can lose their jobs. It's a tourism economy, so it fluctuates. And so you can't assume that everyone's going to be financially stable enough to pay, or people just, they just, human nature, right? They just decide they just don't want to continue paying and they got their pot of money and they're done. And so then they exit the program, but then the rest of the people have to be responsible for, because otherwise then they're going to be, their credit is going to be dinged. They won't be able to take out another credit. It might affect them. They might actually have to, use their collateral to cover the cost of the debt. And so that did really create the situation for her that was really devastating for her, because she just didn't think that she had a lot of faith in the people that she was, they were her friends, they were her neighbors. And for them to do that to her was really devastating.
Speaking of not paying, I'd like to talk about resistance. In chapter 4, you discuss Mariela and Francisco. They are a Maya couple who you are close to, and who attempt to keep their house through a strategy of what you call waiting out the state and other actors, such as creditors. Can you explain the resistance and explain how we might conceive of foreclosure as a disciplinary act, as you argue in the book?
Mariela and Francisco were a couple who had purchased a home in Paseo Escobar, the housing development that Fox inaugurated. And they had been very excited about purchasing this home, but then they did not anticipate that they would actually end up having financial troubles when Francisco became sick and he wasn't able to then make, his mortgage payments. What's interesting about their case is that, these housing developments were constructed and they were supposed to be affordable, but they weren't quite affordable for the working class. So the ways that when Fox instituted his reforms, the reforms included is that in the past, if you wanted to purchase a home through what's called Infonavit, it's a housing workers fund that allows, it requires all employers to allocate 5% of employees' wages towards a down payment of a house. Now, prior to 2000, most working class residents, even though they were all enrolled in this program because it's a nationwide program, they actually couldn't purchase a home because they couldn't afford a home. So the number of points that they had accrued towards a down payment on a home were relatively small. And the mortgage for a home for homes in Cancun were more expensive. And so with the development of tract housing, all of a sudden you had these affordable homes that local residents thought they could afford. But when they went to purchase these homes, they realized that they were just shy of the amount needed. But the housing reforms made it possible for now local residents to peg that, the Infonavit loan, mortgage loan, which was government subsidized and fixed, with a subprime loan that was not fixed, that was pegged to the dollar. And so Mariela and Francisco did this. They purchased their home, and then they purchased the remaining of the amount, the home that was not covered by the Infonavit loan, with a subprime loan. And at the time, they thought it would be okay because he had a good job. They were both employed full time. They didn't have any kids, and they did not anticipate that he would become sick. And so when he became sick, he was still working, but not as much as before. So he was still able to pay his Infonavit loan because that was garnished from his wages. And it was a fixed interest rate, and it was a very small amount of money over a 10-year period. But the subprime loan, because it was pegged to the dollar, and he got sick around the time, close to the Great Recession, when the recession happened, and the Mexican peso just, lost a lot of its value, then it went from 8 pesos to double the amount. And so all of a sudden, the loan ballooned. And so then it just made it impossible. He realized he couldn't pay back this loan. And then what complicated the matter is that the mortgage lender, Su Casita, went into bankruptcy. And so those loans were bought out by another company. And then that company ended up selling out those loans. And then it was bought out by another company. So the local residents didn't know who they owed money to. So he decided, I'm not going to pay. I'm just going to wait, hold out. And everyone, he was told that if he didn't pay, he would actually be foreclosed on. And so Mariela and Francisco realized and said, in the end, they didn't know if they would be able to hold out and be, they just imagined it would be impossible for them to pay back this ballooning loan. They were still paying back the Infonavit loan. They were still current with that loan because it was garnished from his wages, but the ballooning loan, they weren't current with at all. And so they decided, well, we're just going to wait it out. And instead of, thinking, through foreclosure proceedings, the government was intent on either evicting residents or forcing them to become current with their loan. And so that's when I talk about foreclosure being a disciplinary practice, is because it really is, there is a level of coercion that happens, right? Because if you don't pay back your loan, then you're forcibly evicted. And you're, the agents who would come and tell people that you have to pay back their loan, you owe money to the company, they would come in and they would bully local residents. They would threaten them with bringing the police. They would bring the police on occasion. So people really felt threatened by this process. So that's why I talk about foreclosure being a disciplinary tactic, because it forces people to actually, abide by these and pay these ballooning loans, or then it forces people out of their homes. And so it's a very kind of violent process. And so Mariela and Francisco realized, instead of abandoning their home, which is what people were telling them to do, because they said, you can't pay, so you have to leave. We're going to foreclose on you. They decided to wait it out. And they said, they played a waiting game with the government. And they said, we're just going to wait. We figure we have about 10 years, because in Mexico, you just can't force people out, even if they're deemed as squatters. There's a legal process by which you have to go through the courts. And so they thought, we figure we have about 10 years before the government can come in and force us out. And in that process, we're going to wait it out. And we hope that during that time period, we can figure out a way to legally challenge these foreclosures, because we're current with one loan, but not current with the other. We still have stakes in one loan. And they were hoping to pressure the government, because it was a government loan, to negotiate with the mortgage company to allow them to continue to stay in their home. And so that's why I talk about them waiting it out. Normally, people talk about, like Javier Ollero, the sociologist, talks about waiting as a way for governments to create subordinate subjects, because people have to wait in line, to receive government handouts. They have to wait in line to get, you have to wait in line to get land allocated to you by the government. And so this process creates subordinate subjects. And so what Mariela and Francisco do by waiting it out is they actually take that an act of subordination, and they convert it into an act of political insubordination, because they're trying to subvert government practices. They're trying to subvert capital by saying, we recognize that we have, we can use time as a way for us to gain a foothold in this process, or at least figure out another solution to our housing dilemma.
You explain that in being treated like urban residents, Maya migrants are deracialized. And you propose the term indigenous urbanism. Here I'm quoting you, once indigenous people move to cities like Cancun, they are no longer perceived to be indigenous. And so I'm wondering, what are the consequences of this shift broadly, and how does it relate to changing conceptions of land?
Well, indigenous pueblos in Mexico have rights. And they also have rights to, and these rights include the rights to resources and to support, you know, by the government. And so when they move to cities, they aren't given access to these rights. And so that's why I say they're treated as deracial subjects, because their indigeneity or their identity as, you know, or membership in an indigenous pueblo is not recognized in Cancun. Even though they have not, they still remain members of this pueblo, but it's not translated as, you know, as a recognizable way of dealing with the government, right? And so they're just treated like any other citizen. And so that's part of the reason why I say that they're deracialized. And in terms of consequences in relation to land, what this means is that because indigenous pueblos have rights in the countryside, they also have a lot of autonomy about the way they manage their land, about their relationship, you know, the kinds of relationships they have with the government, the kinds of requests that they can make to the government. Like they're given, you know, health care, they're given education, they're given, you know, they're also, their land rights are protected and supported. And when they go to cities, they don't have access to these rights. So all of a sudden, their relationship to land is not based on collective landholding system. It's based on this idea of individual property rights. And individual property rights are not vested or do not take into account indigenous relationships to land. I mean, land for indigenous, for Maya communities, land is not seen as just this way, this it's not seen as an investment. Land is a, it's, you know, it's a way for them, it's seen as a way for them to have autonomy from the state, because land gives them rights. It's seen as part of, you know, their ecosystem. It's seen, you know, they're part of an ecosystem. It's seen as part, you know, it's seen in relationship to their own understanding of the cosmos. It's seen as part of, you know, religious practices. And so land itself has a lot of multiple connections, right? And so when you go to the city then and you're negotiating for access to land, then the city governments actually don't account for those relationships. They don't take that into account at all. And what they're basically saying is, we don't, you know, they dismiss those relationships altogether. The only thing that's recognized is their right as residents of Cancun, as settlers, right? Because their position as settlers, their rights as settlers to request access to land or to participate in Infonavit and request access to a loan. And so that's the challenge of this, the way that indigenous pueblos are articulated or conceived of in Mexico, is that they're very much relegated to particular geographic spaces, and they're not allowed. I mean, and they don't account for diasporas, and they don't account for the fact that, you know, people move, but they still retain membership. So the people in Cancun are still members of the community of Cuchumil. But that membership is only valid when they're in Cuchumil. That membership isn't recognized in the city.
Well, I think I have taken up enough of your time today. Thank you for the book. It's what's amazing about your book is that these interlocutors that we have discussed and we've named thus far constitute only a small fraction of the characters that you talk about in your book. There is a richness to your description and analysis that I appreciated while reading. And I highly encourage our listeners to pick up a copy wherever they might be able to get one. One last question for you. Can you tell us a little bit about what you are working on these days?
Well, I have a couple of projects. I am working on I'm working on an essay on Maya music and thinking about its relationship to Maya diasporas in California, but also within the peninsula. There's a really really rich, robust group of Maya rappers who live in small communities in Yucatan, and so I'm looking at their relationship to land through rap and through, and we're also linking it to corridos. So that's one project. But then my next book project is actually thinking about settler colonialism, because one of the things about this book that I on Cancun is it took me a long time to figure out how to think about Cancun as a city, as a tourist center. So I started off thinking about it as a tourist center. I started thinking about it as a sort of metropolitan city. And what settler colonialism allowed me to do is to really thinking of Cancun as an indigenous space. And if we begin with that premise that Cancun is an indigenous space, then how doesn't that change the way we think about the city, the way we think about the way the city has been planned, the way it's been imagined, the way it's going to be reconfigured for the future? So if we begin with that premise, I think it really allows for a new understanding of thinking about the city in relationship to global economies and tourism that was, the indigenous component was missing before. And so now I'm taking this idea of settler colonialism and thinking through my own family history. I was born in the state of Colima. And so I'm looking at Colima and settler colonial practices in Colima in relationship to the hacienda economies that dominated the state for a very long time, and thinking about how the haciendas ended up erasing Afro-Mestizo communities and also indigenous communities. And then thinking about the alliances that have been forged between Nahua pueblos and Afro-Mestizo communities in my own family. And so that's my next project.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Bienet Castellanos. Your book is Indigenous Dispossession, Housing, and Maya Indebtedness in Mexico. It's been a pleasure to speak with you, and I am honored to have done so. Thank you. And goodbye. We'll see you next time.
Thank you very much, Joel.